You ever had a tiny itch? It may be bothersome, but it doesn't take too much effort to reach out and scratch that little itch. But what if you can't reach that tiny little itchy spot? How irritating can that be? Now, 10 years ago, I started to have a little itchy spot in the middle of my back between the shoulder blade and the spine. And man, that thing would itch and I just couldn't reach it no matter how I tried. And I finally figured it out, and I'm teaching school, and how do you do this without being undignified in front of other people? So I found if I backed up to a doorway, you know, on a sharp edge or a corner, I could, when nobody's looking, I could itch, or maybe against a file cabinet to do that, just to satisfy that little itch of the ears. And it just bothersome, but it kept coming. It was unpredictable as to when it would come, so I went to a doctor and I said, why is this little itch? And he says, well, if you put this little tiny skin type patch over it, you do it every day for 30 days. That'll help resolve the issue. I did it faithfully, didn't do a thing, didn't resolve anything. Well, my wife has gotten really good at identifying that itchy spot about the size of an apple in the back where I can't reach. And so otherwise it just drives me bananas, that little itchy spot, and then it just gets worse and worse, and the more you think about it, the worse it gets. Well, the simplest way was then the itch didn't go away. And so, and I never knew when it was going to come back to bother me. So I called it predictably unpredictable. I could predict that I never knew when it was going to hit. And so, and we have each one of us in our lives something that is predictably unpredictable. In other words, you know it's going to hit. You don't know exactly when. You don't may not know exactly how. But sure enough, one of those things, it's going to hit. And there is something that's going to happen. We don't know when. Merriam-Webster defines the word evil as morally reprehensible or sinful or wicked. So every day of our lives, we have to be on guard against this predictably unpredictable intrusion of evil in our life. It can sneak into our lives in the smallest way, most clever way, like a tiny itch, or perhaps maybe like a dripping faucet. If you ever had a dripping faucet, it drips once in a while at first, just a little bit of a drip, and then the drip might become faster and faster. And then you realize how much it's going to cost when the big water bill comes at the end of the month and that drip, drip, drip has been going. And had you realized it, it would be easier and cheaper to fix the leaky faucet than it would be to just ignore the little drip, because it's not going to get better on its own. It's going to have to be fixed. Well, today I want to cover the subject of confronting evil. And that's the title of today's message, Confronting Evil. I want to look at seven different people in the Bible to show how they confronted evil, whether it was little or big. And of course, if it's in the Bible, it's mostly often the bigger ones, and each in their own way. Now, and we're going to go back to the time of King David ruled the 12 tribes of Israel, and then we had his son Solomon followed up with the 12 tribes of Israel, and Solomon had his son Rehoboam and was the king of all Israel until a breakaway rebel called Jeroboam took 10 tribes to the north to rule over them and left two tribes to the south, Judah and Benjamin. And so Rehoboam to the south, Jeroboam to the north, and Jeroboam, as the Bible will tell us, was quite evil and tried to draw people away from God. First, he tried to paper it over, as it were, make it look like, you know, they were really worshiping God, but introduced a lot of untruths. Well, then a number of evil kings came in the north that followed Jeroboam. And it came to King Ahab, and who married a foreign woman and who became Queen Jezebel. And they were the worst of the worst, worshiping pagan idols and having pagan priests trying to displace God's truth completely. Jezebel would kill the prophets of God. And interestingly enough, there was a governor of Ahab and Jezebel's household. And the governor was a believer in the true God. And his name was Obadiah. And this governor, he was in a predicament. Now imagine you being the governor of the worst king on record, of the one that was really evil. What do you do? How do you survive that circumstance? How do you take care of business while you're working for that situation? Well, Obadiah, and if we read, and I'm going to read through parts of 1 Kings 18, but Obadiah, when we look at 1 Kings 18, we can read about this circumstance, because he was the governor, he had to make good choice, meaning of the household or household manager. I know a fellow who was the household manager of another governor at another time in another state. He was a church member. The governor obviously was not, and had a lot of raucous parties at the governor's mansion, and he was the manager of it, and he was busy pulling his hair out trying to somehow do it. And that wasn't a governor who was didn't have the record being evil as King Ahab. But here we have Obadiah as the governor of the king's household. In 1 Kings 18, starting in verse 2. And it tells us there was a severe famine in Samaria. That's the northern 10 tribes of Israel and Samaria. And Ahab called Obadiah, who was in charge of his house. And we read, Obadiah feared the Lord greatly, for so it was while Jezebel massacred the prophets of the Lord. Remember that evil queen Jezebel? She was killing the prophets and priests of God. Obadiah then, it says, took 100 of the prophets and hid them, 50 to a cave, and fed them with bread and water. He kept them alive. Now, can you imagine trying to keep this a secret? You're the governor, and it's a famine. Food is scarce for both livestock and it's a drought and a famine. And he had to, now, if you had to feed 100 people for one day, how much stuff would that take? Mm-hmm. Now, every day, week after week, during this famine, he had the authority to be able to do this. But can you imagine trying to keep it a secret? Because what would happen to Obadiah is that not only would he be killed, but they would discover those 100 prophets that were faithful and he kept them alive. So we have this problem. And so how did he resolve this is to use his position for the best way he could to preserve the life that he could. Did he go up to Ahab and say, you're dumb and ugly and your mother dresses you funny, I hate you all day long? No. He didn't create a problem for the people he was trying to rescue. So his method of confrontation was low key in that sense. Now, incidentally, if we go back and we read then in 1 Kings in 18 and verse 2, we read that Ahab called in Obadiah and says, you know what? We've got to find food for our livestock or we're going to have to kill them. And so he said, you go one direction, I'll go another. Well, they aren't going to go alone. The king's not going to travel. So yeah, his entourage, and he trusted Obadiah, you go and we'll look for grass to feed the livestock. Otherwise, they would have to reduce the size of the flocks and herds so they wouldn't consume everything and everybody. All the creatures died. And while Obadiah's out, he comes across Elijah. And Elijah's a little worried because Queen Jezebel is busy trying to kill everybody who is a prophet of God. Well, if we read on then in 1 Kings 18, where Obadiah said, well, you know, yeah, I can introduce you to King Ahab. And if we go to verse 17, then it happened when Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, is that you, O troubler of of Israel? And he, Elijah, answered, I've not troubled Israel, but you and your father's house have. You've forsaken the commandments of the Lord and have followed the Baals, Baal worship. Now, therefore, send and gather all Israel to me on Mount Carmel, the 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. So there were a couple of foreign gods, pagans, that they were pushing that worship on the children of Israel. So we read on. Now there's a head-to-head confrontation. Elijah says, come on, you know, bring it on, bring it. Let's go to Mount Carmel and we'll just sort this out. And Ahab, invited, it says all Israel. We don't know how many people came. We know that there were likely thousands, of people there. And brought them, and there was this confrontation. And the confrontation was, if we read through 1 Kings 18, that, now mind you, this is a drought and a famine, but Elijah said, let's build an altar up here, and we'll have, and we'll give all of your false gods, all of their priests and prophets, and we'll see if they can ignite this sacrifice on this altar, cutting up the ox and putting it on the altar, and if their God can light the fire. And it says that those pagan priests danced and shouted and cried out, but remarkably, in their minds, it should have taken place, and nothing happened. Did not light the fire. Then Elijah says, okay, now we'll dig a trench around this altar. We'll pour water all over the sacrifice that we've prepared and fill the trench with water. So nobody can say the fire snuck in from the side. It's got to be supernatural. And Elijah asked God to ignite the fire. And it happened that it was consumed. The entire, and licked up the water in the trench, if we read in 1 Kings 18. Well, Elijah had that direct confrontation with King Ahab, and following that, he asked the people, you know, who they would rather follow, and they gathered up the pagan prophets, and they were executed. In other words, they said, yeah, we can't be having this sort of stuff. We can see who the true God is, at least for that time. So we have this confrontation, very vivid description of Elijah confronting King Ahab. Then we have the example of Nehemiah. Now, the children of Israel were conquered and carried away by an empire to the east. And they were all dragged away and kept in captivity for 70 years. They kept away, they emptied, they were conquered and dragged away. And then after many years, Nehemiah went to the conqueror and said, you know, I really miss our homeland. I want to go back. So I'd like to go back and I'd like you to authorize me to do so. And I'd like a letter so I can get materials to rebuild the area. And so the emperor gave him permission to do that. After all, he had been a faithful, was not a rebel. And so Nehemiah went back to rebuild the wall around Jerusalem. And he began to do that. And if we read in Nehemiah 6, in fact, I'm going to quotations. And I'll jump right to it. Just before Esther, we go to Nehemiah 6. Now, if you've got a big project that you want to do, and you're focused on getting that project done, you don't like distractions, right? You want to get things done. And so Nehemiah was busy building the wall in chapter 6 when it happened that Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem the Arab and the rest of our enemies, see, they had still had enemies living in the area, had heard that I had rebuilt or should be rebuilding the wall, that there were no breaks left in it. They were closing it up, that they hadn't hung the doors and the gates. And then Sanballat and Geshem sent to me, verse 2, saying, come, let us meet together among the villages in the plain. But they thought to do me harm. In other words, the wall isn't completely completed because the gates aren't up. They aren't closed yet. It's still vulnerable. And they openly pleaded, the enemies of Nehemiah and the Israelites, said over and over again. But Nehemiah wasn't going to be distracted. Then we go down to verse 5. And Sanballat sent his servant to me as before the fifth time. So he's begging him, come and have a meeting. And it was written, it's reported among the nations, and Geshem says that you and the Jews plan to rebel. Therefore, according to these rumors, you're rebuilding the wall that you may be their king. And you've also appointed prophets to proclaim concerning you at Jerusalem, saying, there's a king in Judah. Now these matters will be reported to the king, meaning the emperor. So therefore, come, let us and consult together. Have you ever heard of the term fake news? This is it right here. They were spreading rumors and saying, you are going to be, that you're really just trying to take over. You're trying to be the new dictator here. And we're telling everybody, and we're going back to tell the emperor who sent you here that you are going to repel. It's remarkable how the fake news prophets always come up with bad news for which serves only them, okay, and not reality. So, but how did Nehemiah handle this? He didn't go meet with them. He basically stiff-armed them, kept them away, and said, basically, they're not going to be engaged or involved in what we do and how we do it. And so that was Nehemiah's approach. Don't get involved with those people. And of course, he also said in verse 14, may God remember Tobiah and Sanballat according to their works, and the prophetess Nodiah and the rest of the prophets who would have made me afraid. They were trying to induce fear. But he had to be strong enough not to be afraid of those who wanted to induce fear to put a stop to the building of the wall in Jerusalem. So that's the third example was Nehemiah. How he confronted evil is don't bring him into his life. Don't bring him in. The fourth characteristic, and this is probably one of the most uncomfortable ones, is the example of Phinehas, Phinehas, Phinehas. And if we read in Deuteronomy 30, and I will, this story, we'll get back to it in Deuteronomy 30. Deuteronomy 30, it come to pass when all these things come upon you, the blessing and the curse which I've set before you, call them to mind among the nations in your people. And it goes on, the importance of being faithful. Now, bear in mind, this is before the children, after the children of Israel came out of Egypt, before they got to the promised land. So we don't have, just so we put it in the time and place. And what were they told before that? And we can, if you can put your finger in there and look at Numbers 25. We'll go back a book and look at Numbers 25. Numbers 25, and the first 13 verses that I have in my notes is, and it talks about here, the people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab. And they invited people to the sacrifices of their gods. And the people ate and bowed down to their gods. These are Israelites who had come out of Egypt. And Verse 3, and Israel was joined to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel. He warned them, don't do this stuff. And then they went and they started practicing false religion with the locals. So when you read harlotry, we're looking at both personally, physically, what people did, as well as spiritually in both avenues. And verse 4, and the Lord said to Moses, take all the leaders of the people and hang the offenders before the Lord out in the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel. And so if we take a look here and reading on, and Moses said that all of those who were joining with Baal Peor, they must be killed. And there was one, verse 6, about somebody who went in with a Midianite woman in the sight of all Israel. In other words, openly defying God, defying Moses. And he said, don't do this. And Phinehas went in and took a javelin and thrust it through them in chapter 8. Well, what happened then is, not only did he kill those two people who were fornicating, but if we read then in verse 8, so the plague was stopped among the children of Israel, because there was a plague going on, and those who died in the plague were 24,000. Know of any towns around here about that size? How about several towns added together of that size? And so Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, a grandson of Aaron the priest, was very zealous and said, if God said it, Moses said it, I'm going to do this. So how did Phinehas, what did he do? He staved off a plague with his vigorous action, because thousands of people were dying and they had to set forth to be distinguished between God's way of doing it and the pagans. So if we take a look then and back in Deuteronomy 30 and verse 15, see that I have set before you today life and good, death and evil. And in that I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, keep his commandments, his statutes and judgments, that you may live and multiply, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land which you go to possess. They hadn't gotten to the promised land yet. But if your heart turns away so that you do not hear and are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I announce to you today that you will surely perish. You will not prolong your days in the land which you cross over the Jordan to go in and possess. So I call heaven and earth as witnesses today against you. I've set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life, that both you and your descendants may live. But you know, it's remarkable how every generation seems to forget that. Every generation has to learn that, apparently, on its own, or we wouldn't have had the case of generations later about Ahab and Jezebel and the worship of the pagan Baal gods, the local gods, and people going in that direction. So what did Phinehas do? He took up the cause of saving the people of Israel from all dying of the plague that was afflicting them, because many of them were leaving the worship of the true God and going after the false gods. The fifth example is of Samson. Now, I suspect we've all heard of Samson. and in Samson, and I'm going to take a look here in the book of Judges, and Samson was a judge of Israel. He was not a king, but a called up ruler for a special purpose. And and he was a judge in Israel for 20 years. The problem with all of the judges were, they were humans. And what afflicts humans? Temptation. I mean, I had a guy tell me once, look, I can resist anything but temptation. Well, that doesn't work out very well, but Samson was human, and he was tempted, as are all of we, from time to time. And he was a strong man. I mean, how many people could take the gates of a city, pick him up, and walk him up to a hill and leave him there just to show he could? That's a pretty strong dude. And of course, but he was enticed. And I presume you've heard the name Delilah. If you ever wondered why in school children you don't hear any of the girls named Delilah for thousands of years now, that's just the name that's been reprehensible. People just aren't doing it. Somebody might do it as a nickname just for funsies something. But she was a local woman, a Philistine, and he allowed her to lead his heart astray. She was deceiving him and deceived him as a judge of Israel. And as a result, led him to violate his Nazirite vows, rendered him weak, and the Philistines captured him, and they put out his eyes. Because how can the strong man, who's stronger than any known person, then how could he function, use his strength if he couldn't see? And so when we read through this in Judges, particularly in Judges 16, it took time for Samson, as a Nazirite, for his hair to regrow, for him to recover his strength, even though he was blind. And if we take a look in Judges 16, and verse 23, the lords of the Philistines gathered together to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their God, and to rejoice. And they were rejoicing and said, God has delivered into our hands Samson, our enemy. And they praised their God, Dagon, for they said, he's the destroyer of our land and multiplied our dead. Because Samson was so strong, he had, particularly in battle. And they were having a big party. And if we read on, there were 3,000 Philistines, the elite the elite of the Philistines that had conquered Israel, and they all met at the temple. 3,000. How big is that building anyway? And if you stop and look at how big that building had to be for 3,000 people to be in it, it's got to be a big building. And how do you hold up the roof to that building? You got a pretty solid walls, and they had pillars that would hold up those walls. Or hold up the roof beam, I'm sure. And what did Samson do? He was blind. And if we read in here, verse 26, Samson said to the lad who held him by the hand. You see, that's how he got around. They wanted to put Samson on display. Here's the big guy who fought Israel, but now we've got him and we'll display him. Sort of like a zoo, and they have a zoo animal in a cage. Well, he had a little boy who would lead him around. So he asked the boy in verse 26, Judges 16:26, let me feel the temples, the pillars which support the temple, so I can lean on them. And it talks in verse 27 about 3,000 men and women on the roof watching while Samson performed. So they were having him do things. And then verse 28, Samson prayed that God would take his life to save the life of Israel and to destroy the Philistines. And that's what he did, is he pushed the pillars apart. He had regained his strength, took down the roof, and the temple fell, and all the people that were in it died. It said there were more at that time that died than he had killed in his entire life. And so you have this, how did Samson confront evil? He was he was good in battle, but then he was weakened by temptation, got misled, allowed himself to be misled, and then at the end of his life sought to redeem himself and the people of Israel to save them from the grief that he caused by not being an effective leader. And so He tried to redeem himself then at the end of his life, giving his life for the people of Israel. The sixth example we have, and that is in Luke 3, starting in verse 18, is a fellow whom I'll call John the Baptizer. Now, John the Baptist is commonly called John the Baptist. I'm going to call him John the Baptizer. Was actually a first cousin or a cousin. His mother and John the Baptist's mother were cousins. And so he was related to Jesus the Christ. We read in Luke 3 in verse 18. In Luke 3:18, I get there. There we go. Helps to be in the right chapter. With many other exhortations, he preached to the people. But Herod the Tetrarch, meaning the ruler, being rebuked by him concerning Herodias, his brother Philip's wife. King Herod took his brother's wife, married his brother's wife, because he was the king. He could do whatever he wanted. But what did John the Baptist do? He had rebuked the king for that, and then it says, for all the evils that Herod had done. How many of us are willing to go stand before the ruler of the land and tell him to his face that you're an evil creature, you've done all of these things, not just in your personal life, but in the lives, about what all the evil you've done to your people. And what happened then is, of course, you read in verse 20, well, how do you keep somebody like that quiet? Well, he was very popular, so Herod said he didn't want to do something that was too unpopular, so he threw him in prison. But we note that John the Baptizer chastised or rebuked King Herod for all the evil which he had done. And he went to prison. There was a consequence. For everything, every confrontation, there was a consequence. Now we go to the book of John. We'll follow up on the story in John 14. At the time, Herod the Tetrarch heard the report about Jesus, meaning Jesus was preaching, and said to his servant, because this is John the Baptist, he's risen from the dead. These powers are at work in him. Because you see, King Herod wanted to put John the Baptizer to death, but he feared the people, the multitude, because they counted him as a prophet. But what happened was on Herod's birthday, his wife's daughter came and danced, and so swept away with emotion, he said, I'll give you whatever you want. And so what did the daughter do? She said, I want John the Baptizer's head on a platter. Now Herod was in a predicament. He didn't want to displease his wife and stepdaughter. He didn't want to displease the multitude, but he had made a promise. And he would look foolish in front of his whole court if he didn't do that. Verse 9, and the king was sorry. Nevertheless, because of the oaths and because of those who sat with him, he commanded it, meaning the head, be given to her, and had John beheaded in prison, and then brought it to the girl and gave it to her mother. And then his verse 12, his disciples came and took the body away and buried it and went and told Jesus. You see, when Jesus was preaching, then Herod thought, oh no, is this John the Baptizer? Did he come back to life? I thought we cut his head off. But that's not what happened. What did John the Baptizer do? Did he go hide in the closet? No. He told the king to his face about his sins, specifically and generally. And it cost, and it was a price. So his, he confronted evil, and we can read about it. So that was the sixth example, would be John the Baptizer. There's a seventh example. And I'm going to ask you if you've ever seen the bumper sticker WWJD. Ever see that one? And then in the other print, it would say, what would Jesus do? It's sort of inducing you to make a good decision as to what would Jesus do. Well, I'm going to suggest a better bumper sticker would be WDJD, what did Jesus do, rather than not what would Jesus do. So if we look in Luke 13, and starting in verse 31, what did Jesus, the Christ, do? He called Herod a fox. Now, would you do that and publicly and be quoted? Okay, in a time, there was no such thing as free speech. Tell that to John the Baptizer, who lost his head over the issue. But verse 30, Luke 13, 31, on the very same day, Pharisees came and said to him, get out and depart from here because Herod wants to kill you. Verse 32, and he, meaning Jesus, said to them, go tell that fox, behold, I cast out demons and perform cures today and tomorrow, and the third day I'll be perfected. In other words, I'm not going to stop. Okay? Go tell him. I don't care if you tell Herod. Okay? So he didn't mind speaking truth to King Herod. Go ahead. Go tell him. Matthew 22 and verse 5. Matthew 22 and verse 5, starting in 22, verse 15. And the Pharisees went and plotted how they might entangle him, meaning Jesus, in his talk. And they sent to him their disciples with Herodians, her followers of Herod, saying, teacher, we know that you're true and you teach the way of God in truth. Did they really think that what he was teaching was true? Or are they trying to butter him up and mislead others? And verse 18, but Jesus perceived their wickedness. Why do you test me, you hypocrites? These were the ruling religious leaders of the day, the Pharisees. He didn't mind calling them what they were, and that was hypocrites. Hypocrite meaning saying one thing but doing another. Espousing one principle, but then not living by that principle. We turn to the next chapter, in chapter 23, in verse 13. He didn't limit the title of hypocrite to only Pharisees. Matthew 23, 13. But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither go in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. So he added to it, not just Pharisees were hypocrites, but the scribes were. We're in going through Matthew. We go to the next chapter in Matthew 24. This is more of what did Jesus do? In Matthew 21, back to Matthew 21 and verse 12. And this is at a time when Jesus cleansed the temple. In Matthew 21, verse 12, Jesus went to the temple of God and drove out all of those who bought and sold in the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats who sold doves. And he said, it is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, and you have made it a den of thieves. You see, people were having to buy animals to sacrifice. And if you've got a captive market, where people couldn't, you know, and they traveled for some way and they're expected to provide a sacrifice. It says a den of thieves means they were being overcharged. It's hard to read it in any other way. But we read more out of the story in John 2, starting in verse 14. In Matthew 21, we read about overturning the tables of the money changers' tables and the seats of those who sold doves. In John 2, and starting at verse 14, he found in the temple those who sold oxen and sheep and doves and the money changers doing business. And he made a whip of cords. One little cord probably isn't going to be enough. So if you braided several together, and I remember doing that as a kid, braiding a number of twine strings together to make a rope. He drove them, the livestock, out of the temple, the people, with the sheep and the oxen, and poured out the changers' money and overturned the tables. And he said to those who sold doves, take these things away. Do not make my Father's house a house of merchandise. So how did Jesus confront the evil? He was busy purging the temple, setting a high standard that says these things ought not be done. In Luke 8, we have an example of what did Jesus do. In Luke 8, starting in verse 26, and here's a case where in the next 10 verses, it's about coming across a man who was demon-possessed. And the man was clearly problematic for all of the people around him. And it said he had been, verse 27, he had been a certain man from the city who had demons for a long time. He wore no clothes, nor did he live in a house, but in the tombs, in other words, underground. And then when he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell before him and said, what do I have to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? You see, even the demons knew who Jesus was. It wasn't a surprise to them. They knew. And the demons continued, I beg you, do not torment me. For Jesus had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man, for it had often seized him, and he was kept under guard, bound with chains and shackles, and he broke the bonds and was driven by the demon into the wilderness. In other words, broke out of his restraints and went running off. But at this moment, then, verse 30, Jesus said, what is your name? And the man said, Legion, because many demons had entered him, and they begged him that he would not command men to go out into the abyss. They wanted to possess a body, and there were lots of demons in one person. Verse 32, what did Jesus do? There was a herd of many swine feeding there on the mountain. Why would there be swine there? Because somebody was not following the food laws of God. And so they begged him that they would permit them to enter the swine. And he permitted them. Then the demons were cast out of the man. They entered the swine. But then what happened? The herd violently ran down the steep place and into the lake and drowned. And with those, verse 34, who fled, who fed them, the swine carers, saw what had happened. They fled and told it in the city and in the country. And it made it into the Bible. The story was well known. And when they went out to see what had happened, they came to Jesus and found the man whom the demons had departed sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed before he had torn off all his clothes. Now he was clothed and in his right mind. And they were afraid. In other words, there's a big change here. Jesus had effected a healing. They also who had seen it told them by what means he who had been demon-possessed was healed. So, was Jesus afraid of controversy? Was he afraid of confronting evil? He took it directly. He took it head on. So if we take a look at these seven characters and how they applied or did things differently, the first one we looked at was Obadiah, and he used his unique position to quietly save the lives of 100 faithful priests, feeding them in a famine. And you can't do that. I can't imagine how hard it would be to keep a secret, but he did it. And if we look at Romans 12 and verse 21, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Isn't that what Obadiah did? He wanted to do the right thing despite all of the circumstances that he was in. The second example was Elijah. Now, he directly called for a confrontation with King Ahab, and he unabashedly carried out a challenge to the pagan gods that Ahab and Jezebel promoted. In 1 John 4:4, and I'm going to read this in the English a common English Bible, 1 John 4:4. You are from God, little children, and you have defeated these people because the one who is in you is greater than the one who is in the world. Because Elijah knew the true God wasn't going to take second place to the pagans. The third example is Nehemiah. Nehemiah did not allow himself or his work crew to be distracted from his task of completing the wall around Jerusalem. He openly identified the propaganda, false accusations, and fake news. His steadfastness and perseverance prevailed. At 1 Peter 5, verses 8 and 9, and 1 Peter 5, verses 8 and 9, made me think of Nehemiah. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary the devil walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him, steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. Nehemiah resisted. He didn't succumb to the temptation to go out and we'll just have a chat to people who did not have his or Israel's best interest at heart. The fourth example was Phinehas. Phinehas knew what was expected, and there was a terrible plague that was inflicted upon Israel for disobeying God, and he took direct action to stave off that plague. And we can take a look at Psalm 37. And Psalm 37, starting in verse 39. But the salvation of the righteous is from the Lord. He is their strength in the time of trouble, and the Lord shall help him and deliver them. He shall deliver them from the wicked and save them, because they trust in him. So the righteous one had to work hard and fast in this case, and Phinehas took precise action. The fifth example is Samson. And we'll turn to Psalm 94, verse 14. Samson, at the cost of his own life, destroyed about 3,000 of the elite leaders of the Philistines. He sacrificed his life to save his fellow Israelites. In Psalm 94, 14, for the Lord will not cast off his people, nor will he forsake his inheritance. Was there a price for Samson? Yes, there was, for the problems that he had allowed to occur. Yet he was attempting to redeem himself by saving his people. The sixth example is John the Baptizer. And we're going to turn to Revelation 20, verse 4. You see, John the Baptizer directly called out King Herod's sins to his face. And he was cast into prison and then later beheaded. In Revelation 20, verse 4, we read about people like John the Baptizer. Revelation 20, verse 4, and I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was committed to them, and I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus and for the word of God. And it goes on to explain that they had not worshipped the beast or his image, not received the mark on their foreheads or hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. Well, the faithfulness that John the Baptizer had is the kind of faithfulness that we will need as we read about in Revelation 20, verse 4, when the beast power is there. I cannot imagine John the Baptizer being willing to take the mark of the beast and go with it. No, he would resist that and choose rather to be headed for the witness of Jesus and the Word of God. The seventh example we have is Jesus the Christ. And what did he do? He labeled people for who they were, whether a fox or a hypocrite. And he took direct action to cleanse the temple by overturning the money changers' tables, driving his livestock out of the temple, driving out demons to heal a longtime afflicted man. Kind of reminds me of a friend of mine. I said, well, what are you going to do about this particular problem? And the friend said, overturning tables, whipping livestock are not out of the question in this case. If we turn to Ephesians 6 and verse 12, Those are physical things that we saw that Jesus was doing in Ephesians 6, verse 12. But he also cast out demons from the afflicted man. Ephesians 6, 12, we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places. So when evil comes our way, we must pray, first of all, that we recognize that it is in fact evil. The next thing is we must pray that we choose the best course of action to confront that evil. And we know that evil can creep into our lives in a very small way, but it might be more efficacious to stomp out the evil while it is still small. Well, we'll be approaching here in a few weeks the Spring Holy Days, and we'll focus on putting sin out of our lives. We have to decide how and when to confront whatever evil that crawls into our lives. At the same time, it's wise to prepare to pray for protection from evil. Now, King David wrote Psalm 140, and he asked precisely for God to protect him from evil men. I want to go over a few verses in Psalm 140, starting in verse 1. Deliver me, O Lord, from evil men. Preserve me from violent men who plan evil things in their hearts. They continually gather together for war. They sharpen their tongues like a serpent. The poison of asps is under their lips. Keep me, O Lord, from the hands of the wicked. Preserve me from violent men who have purposed to make my steps stumble. Verse 5, the proud have hidden a snare for me in cords. They have spread a net by the wayside. They have set traps for me. Verse 6, I said to the Lord, you are my God. Hear the voice of my supplications, O Lord. He was asking for protection, knowing that all these traps that would be set about him, just like we will stumble into and have our entire lives, the snares and the traps, the distractions, and asking God for protection. Learning how to confront evil is essential, even if it only starts as a little itch. We have to know how, then, and when to take action. The reward that for cleaning up our lives is great. In 2 Timothy 4:18, I'm going to read this in the Common Jewish Bible. 2 Timothy 4:18, the Lord will rescue me from every evil attack and bring me safely into his heavenly kingdom. To him be the glory forever and ever. That's what we look forward to. It isn't just avoid the hard stuff, avoid the bad stuff, and then, well, good luck after that. No, there is a reward at the end, and that is joining the God family and being safely brought into God's kingdom, the heavenly kingdom. So let us bear in mind that we have a responsibility and an opportunity to learn how to confront evil. Mr. Irvin.